Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Lana Del Rey, American Idol and Jimmy Iovine. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good.
Good. I have an error to correct.
Yes.
That's how I'm starting this week's podcast.
Notes and corrections.
Yes.
We should do like the newspapers do, and we should
bury it.
Well, exactly. Do this as a separate podcast that goes out in the middle of the night, and where we record it like really quietly like this so that nobody notices that you fundamentally screwed up last week on Setlist.
Yes. Well, not fundamentally. It was an aside anyway. I said last week that Bandcamp last year sold just under 18,000 cassettes. That was incorrect. I misread something. That is, in fact, how many cassettes were released on Bandcamp last year. They don't actually say in their blog post about cassette sales how many they sold. But they do give, as we discussed last week, distances and amounts of time. So from that, I was able to work out roughly the number of sales, although I think there was an error in one of those stats. Because
so they made an error?
Well,
or are you now making another error in saying that they made an error?
Well, it's possible that my math is wrong, but
this will be like The Guardian when their notes and corrections is full of corrections to yesterday's notes and corrections.
Well, either they sold 200 cassettes last year, or they sold 200,000 cassettes last year, based on my extrapolations from different stats they provided.
Yeah, so it's just to clarify on that. That's not that your maths is so imprecise that you're not sure if it's 200 or 200,000. You have taken two separate stats that they delivered, done some maths, and if you were to use stat A, ends up with 200, which would mean that over 17,500 of the cassette releases that went on sale sold no copies. Or...
possible.
They sold 200,000 in total. Although even then, that's not very many copies per release.
No, it's an average of about 11 per release.
In fact...
also, I think, quite possible.
If last week... you hadn't misread the 18,000, let's say 18,000, it's just under, the 18,000 figure as being the total number sold, so that you could then mock that by comparing it to vinyl sales in the UK.
I mean, at 200,000, it's still fairly laughable compared to vinyl.
But almost the fact that 18,000 cassettes were released is a bigger revelation than whether or not any of those were actually sold. That's a lot of cassettes being released.
And that's just on Bandcamp, because actually we dug up some other figures on this subsequently about cassette sales in the US.
Yeah, Nielsen put some stats out.
Yeah, Nielsen, who do the stats counting for the Billboard charts, provided some stats on cassette sales for Billboard's wider review of the year 2017. They reckoned that 174,000 cassettes were sold in the US in total last year. I don't think that includes Bandcamp figures.
Yeah, it's never totally clear when the record industry put out their stats for things like CDs and vinyl, let alone cassette, whether or not they're including the direct-to-fan platforms. Some of the direct-to-fan services do chart return, which would suggest that their figures do then go into the system. But I think quite a lot of direct-to-fan sales don't get counted when people put out their stats for physical product.
No, but nonetheless, Nielsen did create a top 10 of the best-selling cassettes of 2017, which I think, even if Bandcamp isn't included, is still a pretty accurate top 10. And actually, the top three were all cassettes made for the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. So we're more a kind of novelty item because cassette compilations feature in those films. So I'm not sure you can really count them as things people were buying to listen to.
Yeah, they should be in a merchandise chart rather than a cassette release chart.
But the Guardians of Galaxy Awesome Mix Volume 2 shifted 19,000 copies. That's not bad. Volume 1, 15,000. And the Cosmic Mix Volume 1, that sold just 5,000. Those are the top three cassette releases. Below that, the top 10 all sold between 2 and 3,000. So no cassette release, even the biggest ones, are really selling major units.
Yeah, if you take the soundtracks out, Eminem is the biggest. And he shifted 3,000 copies of the Eminem show on cassette. So you're still doing down the cassette revival. I mean, I think the fact that all the figures we discussed on last week's podcast, and there were quite a few, the one that you didn't even bother to read properly was the cassette stats, tells us that you're not really taking the cassette revival very seriously. Even though the whole point of that blog on the Bandcamp website that started all of this was some guy at Bandcamp trying to big up the cassette revival.
I think what you should note from doing several years of this podcast is that I don't take the music industry very seriously. And the cassette revival is definitely quite far down the hierarchy in the music industry. So it deserves no seriousness at all.
So I'm sure we will return later this year to once again deliver inaccurate statistics about the ongoing cassette revival here in the music world.
But anyway, we've got other things to get wrong this week, so we better get on with that. Coming up this week, we've got Sony's settlement with some American idols and Jimmy Iovine's long-term plans at Apple Music. But first, it was widely reported last week that Lana Del Rey was being sued by Radiohead, not least because she confirmed that that was the case. Radiohead seemingly believe that her song Get Free from her recent Lust for Life album is based on their song Creep. And they probably think this because they have listened to her song Get Free. It does sound quite a lot like Creep.
Yeah, if you listen to the two side by side, and of course because this story went quite big last week, because A, there was reports of this lawsuit, and B, Lana Del Rey seemed to confirm that there was a lawsuit. And in addition to that, she started commenting about the dispute on her Twitter feed. So therefore, every single website in the world reporting on this story did the customary two YouTube videos at the bottom of the post, so you can listen to them side by side. And it does sound like she's doing a Creep cover version but didn't learn the words. Certainly the first bit does. It's the verse, actually, isn't it?
It's the verse,
where the chord progression is very clearly the same chord progression.
Yes, and actually, other than listening to them side by side, I went and listened to various mashups that people have made, placing either Lana Del Rey's vocals over Creep or placing Tom York's vocals over Get Free. And the vocals in a couple of places will always go slightly out of tune, but they do fit pretty well over. Actually, I listened to one where they had both vocals together and they fit together quite well as a duet. So, there are some similarities there. I think it is not legally questionable to say.
Wouldn't it be great if the conclusion of all of this was Lana Del Rey going on tour with Radiohead? And then the encore could be the two of them doing that. There was at least one of those mashups had gone with Lana Del Radiohead as the name. Don't you miss the era of the mashup, where every week there was a flurry of corny gag titles for the latest mashing together of different music? But anyway, as we said, this sort of became newsworthy because the album came out last summer.
Yes.
So the fact that the two tracks are very similar, that's not news. What was news was that conversations between Radiohead and Lana Del Rey's people about the similarities between these two songs was going legal. And we mentioned the tweets. So this is what Lana Del Rey said on the Twitters last weekend. She said, "It's true about the lawsuit," which, to be fair, that depends on what it is that we're meant to have heard about the lawsuit.
Well, yes.
She's not actually saying there is a lawsuit. That's assuming that we've said we've heard there's a lawsuit, and then she says it's true there's a lawsuit. What we might have said is, "I hear there isn't a lawsuit," and then she would have said, "It's true about the lawsuit," and then it would turn out that she wasn't lying. I've sort of ruined the end of this story here by saying that.
Yes, that might be something we come on to.
But I'll read you the rest of her tweet, because whether or not there is a lawsuit, there have definitely been conversations between the Radiohead camp and Lana Del Rey camp. Both sides agree to that.
Yes.
That there have been conversations. And this is what Lana Del Rey says about those talks to date. "Although I know my song wasn't inspired by Creep," so presumably if this actually went to court, we would be in the realm of unconscious copyright infringement.
The classic.
Because
it's what did for Elastica, isn't it?
You don't have to set out to infringe somebody's copyright. You may just do it because someone else's song is stuck in the back of your head. When you have subconscious copyright infringement, you have to prove that the other side have heard your music. And actually, that's quite often where those cases fall down. Although, surely everybody's heard Creep by Radiohead.
Yeah.
That could just be taken as a given. You wouldn't even need to have to prove that. So, but anyway, she says, "Although I know my song wasn't inspired by Creep, Radiohead feel it was, and they want 100% of the publishing," which basically means they want the song copyright in the Lana Del Rey work. She said that she offered 40% to them in recent months, but that they will only accept 100. Their lawyers have been relentless. So we will deal with it in court, is what she said last weekend.
Yeah. She then the same night commented on the case at a live show where she suggested that Get Free might be taken off future versions of Lust for Life entirely. Just gone. But then there was a twist, because Radiohead's publisher, Warner Chappell, issued a statement on the matter. What did they say?
Yeah, this is the twist I've already alluded to. So Lana Del Rey put out her tweets. She said that stuff at the gig. Everyone in the world reported on this. All those mashups sprung up. And so then Warner Chappell, who are the publishers of Radiohead, they put out a statement which, well, it was quite polite, but it was basically saying she's wrong. She's not wrong that Radiohead think that she nicked some of their music for her track. She's not wrong about that. But basically they're saying there is no lawsuit. Radiohead have not been demanding 100% of the publishing in ongoing negotiations. Would you like the exact quote?
Sure, why not?
This was a statement issued by a Warner Chappell spokesperson. I love it when quotes come from a spokesperson. So therefore, it's not incorrect for me to do this in my voice, because as far as we know, the Warner Chappell spokesperson might sound exactly like me.
They might.
In fact, perhaps I am Warner Chappell spokesperson.
Maybe you are.
On the side. That would be a conflict of interest, really, wouldn't it?
It would have been. I think you'd know as well.
But the well, I might be acting ignorant to cover up the conspiracy. That could be what is going on here.
Well, you should put on a funny voice then.
I'm not going to. As Radiohead's music publisher, it's true that we've been in discussions since August of last year with Lana Del Rey's representatives. It's clear that the verses of Get Free use musical elements found in the verses of Creep, and we've requested that this be acknowledged in favour of the writers of Creep. Acknowledge is a good, nice, vague word there, isn't it?
Mm.
That presumably means we want a credit. That's quite easy. We want a cut of the copyright and a cut of the money, I'm assuming, but just acknowledged, and that I'm not Warner Chappell's spokesperson, I can't embellish on any of this.
No.
To set the record straight, no lawsuit has been issued, and Radiohead have not said that they will only accept 100% of publishing of Get Free. So that was Warner Chappell's statement in return to Lana Del Rey's tweets and gig comments.
Yes.
As we record this, Lana Del Rey hasn't commented on Warner Chappell's comments, although at that gig last weekend, she kind of said, this is the last I'm going to say on this.
Yes, so she may or may not comment on it. We may or may not have more by the time this show comes out. But in the meantime, it does raise some questions. Firstly, why does Lana Del Rey think she's being sued? And why does she think that Radiohead won't rest until they've got 100% of her song? If you actually go back to the original Sun report, which is where this news came from, that does say that Radiohead are considering suing her. Doesn't say that they are suing her. So when she said it's true about the lawsuit,
providing she'd read the Sun article and that was what she was responding to,
yes, then she would have been saying it's true that there's potentially a lawsuit. However, she did then say in her tweet on the matter that they would sort it out in court. So she was expecting a lawsuit, if nothing else.
Yes, so some confusion there as to who is going to sue who, when, why and how. And then I suppose in terms of the Radiohead are demanding 100%, I mean, usually in these disputes, there are quite a lot of people involved. It's not that Radiohead and Lana Del Rey get round a table and, I don't know, sort it out with an arm wrestle.
No, well, possibly some of the confusion at Lana Del Rey's end comes from the fact that she would not be directly in these negotiations herself. So anything she hears is coming secondhand.
Exactly. There will be managers and lawyers. And then, of course, one party is in the UK, one's in the US. So there may be several layers of lawyers between the differing parties. So therefore, it may be a breakdown in communication.
It may be. Well, 100% is quite a drastic figure.
It does seem quite a drastic figure. It is not entirely without precedent.
The classic example, of course, being the Verve versus the Rolling Stones.
For Bittersweet Symphony. And the argument there was the bit that they nicked was that sort of orchestral bit at the start of that track. And the argument was that that makes the song. The song is that orchestral bit at the start. So therefore, the Rolling Stones, actually it was specifically Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, wasn't it, should get the rights in that. I subsequently heard Richard Ashcroft do a acoustic version of Bittersweet Symphony with none of that stuff that they'd nicked. And actually, it's still a really good song.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that was a particularly good judgment. But the point is, it's not without precedent. And therefore, it would not surprise me if there aren't some lawyers out there, particularly in America, we all know about American lawyers, whose opening gambit, whatever they had been told by their clients, whether that's Warner Chappell or Radiohead or whatever, their opening gambit could well be, we won 100% of
that
copyright.
Well, indeed, the story goes with that was that the Rolling Stones lawyer rang up and said, yeah, we'll take 50%. And the Verve's lawyer went, oh, 50%, that seems quite reasonable. 50% Verve, 50% Stones. And he went, no. 50% Mick, 50% Keith. And so it came to pass.
So anyway, We don't know where all this confusion has come from. What we do know is that Radiohead do think that they should be getting acknowledgement, whatever that means, from the Lana Del Rey song. Talks are ongoing. Maybe it'll go to court. Although it has to be said, there is another quite humorous level to this entire story.
Well, yes, because, you know, in the Warner Chappell quote, it doesn't say acknowledged in favour of Radiohead. It says acknowledged in favour of all writers of Creep, because Radiohead already had to give up a portion of their publishing on Creep to Albert Hammond and Mike Hazlewood for their song for the Hollies, The Air That I Breathe, which was released in 1974. And actually, the verse of that is very, very similar to Creep in the way that Get Free is very, very similar to Creep. So I'm not sure that Radiohead should be getting anything at all. I think probably Albert Hammond and Mike Hazlewood should be credited on Get Free and Radiohead with no part of it.
Yeah, Lana Del Rey's entire case should be about how big a fan of the Hollies she is. And that was clearly the song that she was influenced by. So yeah, back in 1992, when Creep came out, both Albert Hammond and Mike Hazlewood approached Radiohead, and ultimately, at the end of that, they ended up with credits and a cut. So therefore, or if a deal is done between Radiohead's people and Lana Del Rey's people and they get a cut of that Lana Del Rey song, then some of that will be going back to the other two guys as well. It would be interesting, you know, those musicologists that crop up on copyright infringement cases?
I know them.
And we never quite know what they do apart from that one day a year when they go into court.
And they say, yeah, that sounds like that.
Couldn't one of those dig back into the archives of music history to find out who it was that the Hollies track ripped off? Because it's the chord progression, basically. And you do sort of get into...
Oh, well, it is and it isn't. I mean, the verse of The Air That I Breathe and the verse of Creep, like the bass line, the drum, it's all very, very similar. I mean, it's a lot more clear-cut between those two songs than it is between Creep and Get Free, I think.
Is that your expert
That's
opinion?
My expert opinion, if anyone wants to hire me as a musicologist.
But I reckon somewhere in the 1950s catalogue is the track that influenced Albert Hammond and Mike Hazlewood. But I don't know that, of course. And I'm sure it would have been subconscious, even if it had been. I'm making no accusations about any of the people involved in this.
Perhaps, yeah. But that does mean we're without a lawsuit. And everyone knows how much we love a lawsuit. Luckily, in songwriting, you're never more than about 10 minutes away from Ed Sheeran being sued. And he has been again. So that's fun. He's currently being sued by two Australian songwriters over a song he co-wrote for Faith Hill and Tim McGraw. Because as well as being a prolific writer of his own songs, he's a fairly prolific writer of other people's songs. And he does seem to get sued quite a lot. Being accused of ripping other people off.
Of nicking other people's songwriting concepts. So yes, if Warner Chappell insist on continuing with this unreasonable attitude of we're not suing Lana Del Rey, at least we can always rely on Ed Sheeran to keep our count of outstanding plagiarism lawsuits up to a decent level.
Thanks, Ed. Still to come, some news in brief, plus Jimmy Iovine's imminent non-departure from Apple. But now, sticking with lawsuit news.
Or non-lawsuit news.
Or non-lawsuit news. Although this is a case that did actually happen. It did go legal.
And it's been rumbling through the courts for quite some time.
But now Sony Music has settled out of court with a company representing various former American Idol winners.
Yeah, so as we say, this all went properly legal a few years back. So it was 19 recordings, which was part of the 19 Entertainment Empire, which came up with the concept of American Idol. And so back in the early days of American Idol being a thing, you have this company, 19, who made the program. They then also had a management division and a sort of recordings division. So if you were a winner on American Idol, you then jumped over to the management music side of 19, you worked with their team, they then sort of represented and controlled your recordings, but their business partner on all of this was Sony Music. So if you were an American Idol winner, you got managed by 19 and you got signed to Sony Music, and that all went lovely and swimmingly for a number of years. And then 19 got bought by another company, one of Robert F.X. Silliman's companies.
Oh, we haven't talked about him for a while.
No, well, this is another one of his businesses that, albeit after his departure, basically went into bankruptcy. But they bought the 19 business, and then 19 stopped working with Sony Music on American Idol. And then, of course, in the end, American Idol got cancelled, although I think it's coming back, isn't it? Was I reading that American Idol's coming back? I think it is. Anyway, you still have this legacy contract between the former American Idol finalists, who are still represented to an extent by 19, and Sony Music, who distribute the recordings that came out of their initial albums. And 19 sued Sony, and it was sort of a classic catch-all royalties dispute, which across the litigation, they were moaning about all sorts of ways in which Sony Music, when distributing the recordings by these American Idols, how they report how the music's been used and how they share the money. And I think there was a bit about what happens as the money moves between international subsidiaries, a bit about discounts. I mean, all of the royalty gripes that every artist has ever had against their record company were included in this lawsuit. But the reason why it was of interest, and the reason why we're talking about a lawsuit not happening, because the news this week is it looks like an out-of-court settlement has been reached, so it's not going to actually go properly through to court. The reason why we're even talking about that is that in this lawsuit, we also had the sales versus license dispute, which, while some of the record companies would say was all resolved years ago, plenty of artists and managers would say we never properly got resolution on that debate.
Yeah, so the sales versus license dispute was, and I guess still is, about how artists are paid royalties in relation to digital, so downloads and now streaming. Basically, pre-digital artist contracts with labels don't specify a specific download or streaming royalty rate, but they do often distinguish between sales income and license income, with a much higher royalty rate paid on the latter. And because of the confusing way digital is different to physical, download and streaming deals often do look more like licensing deals than sales deals, and therefore a lot of pre-digital artists with older contracts that haven't been rewritten argue that they are owed licensing income on streaming and download royalties rather than sales income, and therefore they're owed more money. And there have been various cases about this where some artists have been successful in making that case.
So yes, in the main, despite all of this, when record companies share income that comes from download stores and streaming services with their artists, if it's one of those old contracts that you're talking about, and therefore it doesn't actually state what the royalty is for the artist on the digital, they pay the sales rate. So I suppose traditionally, pre all of this, in the 90s, money coming in from recordings were either selling CDs and vinyl, and that was what they meant by sales, or it was things like sync deals or compilation deals, and that's what they meant by licensing. And you say they were paying a different rate. Often it's quite a substantial different rate, in that often on a classic 1990s major label deal, the artist will be seeing 15%.
Or less.
Or less. I mean, an older contract's a lot less on a sale, and often a 50-50 split on a license. So it is quite a big difference. And as you say, the agreements reached between the record companies and iTunes, and then subsequently Spotify, Apple Music, etc., well, those are licensing deals. So therefore, what various heritage artists and their managers and lawyers have been saying, well, that's clearly a licensing deal, so therefore, surely that should be licensing income, and therefore, we'll have our 50%, please. And the labels have been saying, no, 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 downloads are the digital version of physical, it's a sale, we'll pay you the lower. You mentioned the lawsuits that we've previously seen on this issue, and by far the biggest was the FBT Productions or Bass Brothers case, what is often spun as the Eminem case, although Eminem himself was not part of this dispute.
No.
But the Bass Brothers are the producers who worked on a lot of the early Eminem recordings, who are cut into those recordings as the producers. Eminem is signed to Universal, and so they were paying royalties over to the Bass Brothers. They were paying the sales royalty on downloads. This kicked off as iTunes started to explode, and suddenly that download income was a lot of money. And so they sued Universal. And that was a case that worked all its way up the court hierarchy in the US. And ultimately, the Bass Brothers won. And the court said, yeah, under your contract, you should get the higher licensing royalty on digital income, which at this point still meant download income.
And then Universal spent a long time saying, this doesn't set a precedent, you know.
Yeah, this is very specific to the Bass Brothers contract. This doesn't apply to your contract, because of course that's what all the other heritage artists were looking for. A precedent being set that said, if you have one of these old contracts that talks about sales and license, then download should come under the license category. We then had a plethora, that's right, a plethora of other lawsuits on this issue, mainly in the US. And a load of those then became class actions. But actually, in the end, most of these were either settled out of court. The class actions obviously had to go through the class action process and a judge had to sign off. But in the main, the result of all of that, and this all kicked off about 10 years ago and was all happening in the latter part of the last decade and the first part of this decade, The outcome of that in the main was that most artists did see the cut of download income they earned go up, but like by 3 or 4% at the most. So we weren't going from 15 to 50. It's more likely you were going from 15 to 18 or something like that. Now, we suspect that quite a lot of the superstar artists behind the scenes on the back of the Bass Brothers ruling possibly negotiated completely secretly much better deals that would then have NDAs attached, so they can't share that information with everybody else. So it may well be that behind the scenes some deals were done with bigger artists, but most heritage acts who couldn't afford to go legal on this in their own right saw their download income rise a few percent. Mainly these were American cases. A lot of people felt that actually, after all of that and a lot of money being spent on legals, that wasn't a particularly good outcome from an artist's perspective. Also, they were mainly US cases. What about in Europe? What about in the UK? What about elsewhere? And then, of course, all of those cases were really iTunes cases. They were about iTunes money. The world moved on. We shifted into the world of streaming. What about streaming? Because sort of, if anything, OK, you can say a download is a digital version of a physical CD, but a streaming service, that's totally a licensing arrangement. So arguably, the case for having the higher license royalty is stronger on streaming than it is downloads, which is why this dispute between 19 and Sony was important, because that was the lawsuit that was specifically asking this question from a streaming perspective.
And had it gone all the way through the court process to having a ruling, it would have answered that question. And that could indeed have set a precedent that could have had a wider knock-on effect, hence Sony really not being very keen on that happening.
Yeah, so quite a few managers and lawyers who pay attention to these things, they have been watching that case with a lot of interest and will be pissed off that we've got another out-of-court settlement, the terms of which will almost certainly be secret. That may well be great for these American Idol finalists who will probably see an uplift in their digital income, not necessarily up to 50-50, but probably they will see more royalties. But because it's out of court, because it's confidential, it means that other artists who may be in a very similar position can't then go to their label and say, hey, I should be getting a bigger cut. And as we discussed in the Dissecting the Digital Dollar reports for the Music Managers Forum, most artists and managers feel that although the labels still invest upfront, they still do all the marketing, they feel the label's risk is less in streaming than it was in physical, and therefore streaming royalties should be higher than physical royalties. Actually, they often are, but I mean by a few percent. And so a lot of artists and managers would say, really, a streaming royalty should be like, well, if the CD royalty is 15, the streaming royalty should be 30. Of course, with new contracts, labels could say, well, if you're not happy with the digital royalty, because a new contract will explicitly say this is the streaming royalty.
Yeah.
So the label could say, well, if you weren't happy with the royalty, why did you do the deal? Now, there's all sorts of debates you can have around the power of some of the labels and whether or not artists have a too weak a negotiating hand, etc., etc. But I think this dispute is all the higher with those heritage artists on legacy contracts where it does all come down to contractual interpretation.
So that's one thing we'll now not get a court ruling on due to this case settling. The other thing we'll not get a court ruling on that was a big part of this case is the kickbacks that the major labels get from the streaming services when they do their deals, so the advances that they receive and how those advances get passed on or not to the artists whose music is then placed on the platform. In court, Sony were very unapologetic about that and saying, we have no obligation to pass on these advances to the artists signed to our label. We're perfectly within our rights to keep all that cash. And then it became a wider issue with a lot more people complaining about it. And Sony did say, oh, yeah, no, we're sorry. We'll hand over that money. As did Warner. I think Universal have yet to comment on that several years down the line.
I think it depends on which of the kickbacks you're talking about, because in addition to the advances, and the dispute is over the unallocated advances, what they call breakage.
Yes.
And whether or not that is shared with artists. Of course, there's also then the equity point that the majors generally get equity in the startup streaming services. And when they sell that equity, will they share it with their artists? And yeah, this is another bone of contention between artists and managers over here and labels over here. It was interesting to see it actually in this case. It was interesting to see Sony saying, ah, under our reading of our artist contracts, we're in our rights to keep the breakage, to keep the profits of our equity sale. But then that became a big issue in the music community. And ultimately, all of the majors made some commitments on both sharing breakage and equity. I can't quite remember the matrix. You're right. I think Warner and Sony are going to share both. I think Universal have committed to share breakage, were a bit vague about what will happen with equity. Of course, the whole equity thing is only really just becoming actually a real thing because Spotify are going to list on the New York Stock Exchange. At that point, the majors will be able to sell the shares that they have in Spotify. So suddenly that will become cash. And then it will be like, okay, are you going to share that now? So yeah, most of the majors have made commitments on this. So we weren't necessarily looking for a judgment on that particular issue in court. Although we will see, once Spotify lists, will the majors immediately sell their stock? And if so, do they make good on sharing that money with the artists? Which I think they probably will, but then you have. But will they be very clear on exactly how they're doing it? And that probably where there'll be more issues.
Yes, and so just in the nick of time, the settlement of this case stops them from having to be clear about it. Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. After we discussed last week Universal's deal with Facebook, Sony ATV has done one now. So
yeah,
that's nice.
If you go back to last week's edition of Setlist, listen to us talking about Universal Music's Facebook deal. But just imagine that every time we say Universal Music, we say Sony ATV, and we've pretty much got that story covered.
The Weeknd and G-Eazy have cut ties with H&M. After the company put up a picture of a black boy wearing a hooded top saying, "coolest monkey in the jungle," which seemed racially insensitive. There was a lot of controversy about it online. And The Weeknd, who has already released a line of clothing through H&M last year, G-Eazy was about to release a line of clothing. So perhaps that's a bigger partnership severance in this case. But yeah, there was a lot of controversy around that. And H&M, despite apologising a number of times, has come out of it badly.
And both of those artists were very quick to come out in public and say, "That's it, I'm not working with these guys.
Yeah.
I don't want to work with people who would make that sort of error."
And lastly, artist and music industry representatives gathered in Westminster last week to back the launch of John Speller's Agent of Change bill in Parliament, which we've previously discussed. That is now being considered for legislation, and as a bill put forward by a backbencher, almost certainly won't become law. But if the pressure is kept up on the government to act on this, then it quite possibly will become part of UK planning law and will hopefully make things easier for grassroots venues in the UK. But we'll see.
Yeah, we've talked about Agent of Change a lot on the podcast before, so if you don't know what that means, go and find an edition where we talked about it. But these proposals were put forward. It has cross-party support. Nobody particularly spoke out against these proposals when it had its first 10-minute reading in Parliament. It will now go to a second reading, which I think is to happen imminently, like this week. But as you say, because it is being led by a backbench MP, usually that doesn't actually become law, either because the government ultimately, when it comes to the crunch vote, uses its actually non-majority in the House of Commons, but it's almost majority in the House of Commons to try and gazump it. Or simply, not enough time is given to the proposals in Parliament, so it never actually goes all the way through the processes to become law because government legislation is already prioritised. But, as you say, it may be that it forces the government's hand. The government have in the past indicated that they are sort of possibly thinking about this anyway, so who knows, perhaps they'll just seize it and then throw it into the next round of planning law that goes through Parliament.
To read more on all of those, head to setlistpodcast.com and head to the show notes for this episode. And finally this week, fake news! Jimmy Iovine has denied reports that he's leaving Apple later this year, despite there being several reports and sources saying that he is.
Yeah, we should stress that Jimmy Iovine denying that he's leaving Apple is not the fake news. The fake news was that he was leaving Apple, and then when Jimmy dealt with those rumours, he described it as fake news, albeit in a slightly humorous, "we should have Donald Trump in here to declare this fake news" kind of way.
Maybe that's a job that Donald Trump could do after he's out of a job as president.
Be just, on call.
Just be on call to shout fake news.
To declare things fake news.
I'm sure he will be. So Jimmy Iovine obviously joined Apple in 2014 when the tech giant bought Beats Electronics, the company he founded with Dr. Dre. Since then, he's been heavily involved in the launch and development of Apple Music. Rumours of his departure started with Hits Daily Double saying that he'd be stepping down in August. Billboard, then apparently dubious of this, went and did some asking around and found various sources willing to confirm it. But it's not happening, or so says Jimmy.
Yeah, so Jimmy Iovine dealt with these rumours during a Q&A because there was a screening of The Defiant Ones, which is an HBO series about his partnership with Dr. Dre. And so while asking questions about that programme, people brought up these rumours, and it was during that conversation that he said, "Fake news, that's not true, I'm in it for the long term." Well, he said he was in the band, didn't he? "I'm still in the band," was
yes.
his line.
Yes, and Apple is not a band, it is a company.
Yeah.
So he's wrong about that. It's not the least confusing thing, he said while he was commenting on this, although he did say he was fully committed to Apple and felt he still had more to do with getting Apple Music and streaming in general to where it needs to go.
Some of the confusing things he said were in relation to a sub-rumour to the rumour.
Yes.
Which was, the rumour was he was going to leave in August. Why August? Well, there was a couple of things floating around, which was, well, his current contract runs out and he isn't going to renew. Then some people were saying, oh, as part of the Beats deal, he got stock options in Apple and he can take up those stock options while he continues to work there. But that in August, he will have cashed all his stock options, so there's no longer any financial incentive for him to stay there. Beyond the, I assume, pretty handsome pay package he will yeah. also be receiving. So that was why summer 2018 was possibly the time when he was going to leave. And he basically said, yeah, none of that's true either.
Yeah, he said all his shares are vested already. And then said, oh, well, actually, some of them do come up in August. So, yeah, but I'm not leaving. Then he said that, yeah, it's true that my contract's up in August, but I don't have a contract. So that was confusing. Basically, he was very adamant that he will not be leaving Apple in August, which probably means he will be out on the 1st of August.
He also discussed how the wider streaming market is performing, because, of course, we know even the successful streaming services are yet to go into profit, and it's all about scale and to keep signing up lots more people. And so part of what he was saying was, you know, the job's not done yet. It's all going very well. We've got over 30 million subscribers, but there's still a lot more to be done and I want to be part of that. Although he did then say, in the last confusing aside, oh, but actually it's the job of the record companies to take streaming to the next level and get a lot more people signed up.
Yeah, he said the record industry right now is expecting technology to fix their problems like they always have. I'm not sure technology is going to fix their problems this time. And he said that they need to make their proposition more interesting.
Although we don't really know what that means.
Don't really know what he means by that. Whether he means they should be doing more exclusives, which Apple Music led on before and it didn't prove very successful, or whether he's just saying that musicians are making really rubbish music at the moment and labels need to find better artists in order to make streaming more compelling. We don't know what he means.
We don't know what he means about bloody Apple Music. I got a new iPhone.
Yeah.
Finally got a new iPhone, an iPhone 8.
Wow.
Used to have an iPhone 5. I spent most of my weekend on the phone to Apple because I wanted to move my MP3s from my 5 to my 8. And I know we're in an age where who cares about the MP3s on your phone. But we were talking about those mashups earlier, weren't we?
Yeah.
I downloaded a lot of mashups in 2004. And one day I might want to listen to them again.
Did you not just plug your phone? I don't understand why that's an issue.
Because my master MP3 collection is on my old Mac, which I no longer have or use, and it's in storage somewhere. I've never put it onto my laptop because I didn't need it, because I only needed it on my phone. So the only copy I had was on my phone. And when I tried to sync my phone to my laptop, the little error message said, OK, so we're going to wipe all the music on your phone and copy over the music that is on your laptop, because the stuff I bought off iTunes had downloaded to my laptop, because you can't stop it from doing that. Also, there were all your various attempts at setlist jingles that you sent over to me when we revamped, which had appeared in my iTunes.
You're claiming this is my fault, man.
So they were in there. And the Signal Radio song was in there, because I have that on all of my devices.
Oh, of course. Well, I can send you that if you need that.
Just to cheer me up occasionally. So it was basically going to wipe all of my MP3s and put the tracks I didn't want, all the setlist jingles, onto my phone. It's like, well, that's the opposite of what I want. So I was like, but there's iTunes Match. That's what that was invented for. I'll use iTunes Match. I'll upload all my music to the cloud and it'll download it to my new devices. Apple have got this covered. Apple do not have this covered. And so I signed up to iTunes Match, paid them my £30. It didn't do anything. Phoned them up.
I have a feeling I read some articles about this about 500 years ago when it was an issue for other people.
Well, you see, that's the thing. So I got through to Apple customer service, spoke to a useless guy, shouted at him. He put me through to a really good person. So that's the trick. When you phone up Apple, just shout at whoever answers the phone. They'll eventually give you to the next layer up of customer service. She was really helpful. Although I say that, she was really helpful. Although after 3 hours on the phone, the conclusion was, yeah, what you want to do can't be done. Because it turns out iTunes Match is shit. And that's what I said to her. I said, oh, I remember when iTunes Match came out, everyone said it was shit, but that was 5 years ago. I assumed you would have fixed it by now. But I suppose, to be fair, they got sidetracked, didn't they, with Apple Music, and stopped worrying about iTunes Match being really rubbish. But turns out, if you ignore Apple and Google, how do I get MP3s from my phone to my laptop, which is what I should have done first.
It really is.
There's a little bit of software you can download, totally unofficial, that does it like that. So,
well, that's handy advice for no one.
For nobody, because no one's interested in this anymore. I felt sort of bad because this girl who had helped me for 3 hours, and although she couldn't help me, she was very nice and very helpful and very patient. And then in the end, once we realised it couldn't be done, I then went on a 10-minute rant about how useless Apple services are. And that's what this podcast is for. I don't need to do that on the phone to poor Apple customer service people. What is it about Apple that their devices and operating systems are so good and their software and services are so rubbish? And it's been like that for 25 years. Of course, Apple Music is one of their services, but I think I include that in that statement.
I feel a 10-minute rant coming on, so I'm going to wrap up this episode set list.
Let's wrap up. I'll go and listen to the Signal Radio song on my phone, and that will calm me down.
If you feel that me stopping Chris going on a rant about Apple services...
Shame you weren't there the other day to save that poor Apple customer care girl from having to listen to my Apple rant.
If you feel that my helming of this podcast is a good thing, you should like, rate, and for God's sake, subscribe to this podcast, because it really helps us in the charts on Apple's podcast services
that are great service.
And I love. You can follow us on all the social media. You can email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Morton, Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.